Astrophysics. So hopefully it won't, changing gears like this won't drop the transmission from the conference, but we'll carry on. First I'll tell you a little bit of some observations of gamma ray burst precursors. So gamma ray bursts, if you don't know, are the most luminous gamma ray sources in the sky. There are several classes of gamma ray bursts, primarily separated by how long they last. There's long gamma ray bursts, which last greater than 2 seconds, and identification of these bursts with cosmological sources, like sources at high redshift, put the luminosities at about 10 to the 54 erg, so pretty enormous energy sources. And it's thought that those are due to collapses of massive stars. I will not be talking about those. What I'll be instead focusing on is short gamma ray bursts, which only last less than 2 seconds. There's some overlap between the two types, but identification of the source of these tend to be more local. They're less isotropically distributed in the sky, and they're sort of nearby galaxies. And so you infer that the luminosities are about 10 to the 50 ergs or so. These are the isotropic equivalent luminosities. It's expected that actually these gamma ray bursts are beamed. The main model for progenitors of these short gamma ray bursts are neutron star black hole binaries coalescing. And the primary instruments that measure these things are the SWIFT BAT, Fermi GBM, and Suzaku. I should point out that basically this guy is the main, SWIFT BAT is the main instrument that has detected most of these short gamma ray bursts, and it's in the hard X-rays, not actually the gamma rays. Okay, so here's a little cartoon picture of the merger of neutron stars. Neutron stars being blue, of course. We have a binary in spiraling, launching gravitational waves, which are red, and it in spirals tighter and tighter until it smacks together. And there may be a little stage in here where a hypermassive neutron star is formed, but eventually a black hole is formed with a little accreting torus around it, and that torus accretes onto the black hole, and 10 to 100 milliseconds after the merger, and this is very uncertain, jets are launched, I guess this guy wouldn't actually be a gamma ray burst since it's pointed away from us, but if we were looking down the barrel, this would be a short gamma ray burst. Gamma ray burst precursors are things that occur before short gamma ray bursts. Precursors are actually mostly observed for Longyearbyens, and there's only a few examples relatively recently of short gamma ray burst precursors. But that's also because there's only a few examples. There's only about 40 examples of short gamma ray bursts in the SWIFT era. Last year, Troya et al. Put out a paper that identified these precursors. There were a couple that were 5 sigma significant, so pretty good detections, 1 to 10 seconds before the main burst. And there were some other ones that they claimed were hundreds of seconds before the main burst, but if you look at it, it was just noise, so I don't believe those. Maybe someone else can tell me different. But here's some data, actual observations, I'm sorry. But you can see here that there's these little bursts before the main burst. So these guys actually triggered the burst detector, and then these guys are the precursors. So you can see here there's one that's 2 seconds, another one that's about 2 seconds. This one's all the way out at 10 seconds, but it wasn't seen by Fermi. And then there's another one here at 1 second. So SWIFT is good for identifying these because SWIFT actually has this mass-weighted aperture that you can identify vague positions in the sky. So these guys are all sort of coincident with position in with the main burst. Fermi's not so good. It's too wide, but at least you can see a kind of correlation in time. So the question then is, what happens about 1 to 10 seconds before before merger, if this sort of cartoon picture of a short gamma ray burst is right? Well, there's a couple precursor mechanisms that were suggested in this paper by Troya et al. There's the magnetospheric interaction. I'm a little skeptical of this in terms of the timing and also the magnetic field that you would need in order to generate the luminosities that's required. Someone can probably tell me better, say, on Wednesday or Thursday. But you seem to need something like 10 to the 15 Gauss field, and things would flare only, you know, pretty close together, like, you know, hundreds of, maybe 100 milliseconds before, or 10, 20 milliseconds before merger. It might be early jet activity, but again, the timing doesn't quite work out. You need to basically delay this main flare for 10 seconds, or 2 to 10 seconds. And what about the cracking of the neutron star crust? The very leading question. Well, it turns out that direct tidal cracking, which Troy et al. Claim explains 100-second precursors, doesn't actually work. They misuse the neutron star mountain results and apply it to tidal fields, which, of course, it doesn't work because a fluid becomes deformed when you stick it. You don't actually need any stress. So, but basically, for direct tidal crust cracking to work, you need delta R over R of the neutron star to be about 0.1, or whatever your favorite breaking strain is. We use 0.1 because of the work by Horowitz et al., but there is some question about shear speed there. But direct crust cracking then doesn't happen until right before the merger. Like, you know, it's off the, so if you look here, 0.1 occurs at almost 2 kilohertz. 2 kilohertz is off my plot over here. So it's somewhere just a few milliseconds before merger. So direct crust cracking probably can't be told apart from the main merger. So we have, instead, come up with a model of resonant tidal excitation. So neutron stars, of course, have normal modes. You guys know this from neutron star astroseismology. The tidal resonance has been explored for G modes and F modes. In fact, G modes are known to heat the neutron star to about 10 to the 8 Kelvin right before they merge. F modes would heat it enormously if you actually excited the F modes before you merged, but I don't think that's the case. But if you include a crust, if you include an elastic crust on top of the neutron star, the modes change. In fact, you add a bunch of different modes. In particular, you add an interface mode, an I mode, at the crust core interface. That's about 100 hertz for the L equal to 2 mode. And it peaks at the base of the crust. So this is an old paper by McDermott. You'll have to pardon the extremely old equation of state used in this calculation. I hope it doesn't offend you. But the point is that this mode looks like an ellipsoidal deformation of the core, and so the companion would be over here somewhere, where the crust then stretches out of the way so that the total deformation of the star is zero, so it stays spherical at the surface of the star. So the crust gets stretched out of the way, and you have this sort of tidal bulge that sort of moves around with the orbit. So, of course, these things aren't tidally locked, so this bulge would basically sort of move around the neutron star as the binary end spirals. The frequency of this interface mode depends on, of course, neutron star structure, where the mode is located, which is at the base of the crust. So it depends on physics near the crust core interface. It depends on the shear modulus, the composition, the equation of state, the transition density to a superfluid core, and, of course, the crust thickness. And then there's also bulk properties like M and R that come into play. So here's some more information about this. So the F mode is an L equal to 2 mode, so it's twice the orbital frequency, which is also the gravitational wave frequency. And the resonant excitation time is about the square root of the radiation reaction time times the... the geometric mean between the radiation reaction time and the orbital time. So the mode can be excited to a very large amplitude. How large of an amplitude? Well, I'm glad you asked. Here we have a quick calculation of the coupling. So this basically measures the strength of how strongly the tidal field couples to the mode. And this dimensionless number comes out to 0.002, which doesn't tell you much right now, but if you plug it into this formula here, shows you that you get about 10 to the 48 ergs transferred from the orbit into this mode. Now, 10 to the 48 ergs turns out to be just enough so that you break the crust if you assume a breaking strain of 0.1. So if you manage to fracture the crust, what happens? Well, we've got a little toy model here, just based on some old starquake stuff. I'm sure there's many, many problems with this, but generally the orbit transfers some energy into the mode. You get 10 to the 48 ergs sitting in the mode, which is just enough to start cracking the crust. The crust cracks. It launches a spectrum of seismic waves, which you can do an impedance matching formula, or impedance matching calculation between the seismic waves and the magnetic field. And that would launch Alfvén waves that, you know, in a hand-wavy way, go up in the magnetosphere. And this perhaps excite pairs and all things, and launches gamma rays. This all, of course, depends on timescales. There's a timescale that takes, there's a timescale between the seismic waves and the Alfvén waves that depends on this transmission. So if the transmission's not fast enough, what can happen is that the energy just builds up in the crust as you're sort of cracking it through this mode. And once the seismic energy in the crust exceeds 10 to the 46 ergs, which is roughly the elastic energy in the crust, the maximum elastic energy you can have in the crust, the thing would shatter. And then you start sort of grinding things up. And then, you know, all the grinding would launch a bunch of high-frequency seismic waves. You'd lose a lot due to dissipation, and maybe you can still transmit some. So depending on the time scales, you're going to get different amounts out. So this implies that if the B field is strong enough, the B field is strong enough such that it's longer than the dissipation time, you should still be able to get a lot of this energy out. Okay, so here's a toy model of this. I stuck in a 10 to the 11 Gauss B field, and you basically get a flare that lasts, you know, on the order of half a second with a maximum luminosity of, 4 times 10 to the 48 ergs per second. So this is basically comparable to the precursor energy seen. If you assume that the main flare is about 10 to the 50 ergs, then this, you know, about corresponds to the height of one of the precursor flares. And these durations, of course, depend on the coupling between the magnetic field and the seismic waves. So we'd like to think that we have a nice model for what happens in there. There's a crust cracking and a flare due to resonant excitation. Of course, you know, if the other neutron star is exactly the same, they would both flare at the same time. If you have two different neutron stars, maybe you could get, you know, two separate flares that maybe you could tell apart. What do we want to do with this? And this is the important part. We want to use this to constrain properties at the base of the crust. So we want to try to do neutron star astroseismology. But the nice thing about this is we can use multi-messenger signals to do it. If we can measure the in-spiral signal with advanced LIGO, then using coincident timing between the timing of the flare and where we are in the signal, then we can pick out the frequency at which the flare occurs. If we can do that, then that's actually really high-precision astroseismology on this neutron star. And it would help constrain the equation of state at the base of the crust and core. Oh, sorry, at the base of the crust, where at the crust-core transition. Like I mentioned before, if you have different neutron star structures in your pair of neutron stars, like, for instance, if one of them is fully catalyzed, the other one has an accreted equation of state because, you know, one of them blew up first and accreted on, and the other one accreted onto it, then you might have multiple flares. And one thing to note is that precursors are probably more isotropic than the gamma ray bursts, which are probably beamed somewhat. And so some of the short gamma ray bursts that we see may actually have been these precursor flares that where we didn't see the main flare, because the energetics are only, like, you know, a factor of 100 less, or 10 to 100 less. So it's possible that we may be confusing some closer ones that are beamed away from us for the short gamma ray bursts.
To what distance do you expect?
That's a good question. It depends on your detector, and I can plug it into my Mathematica to tell you, but I don't. So we can do neutron star seismology from these. So these are other ways to constrain neutron star equation of state using actual astrophysical observations. We have, of course, the neutron star seismology from magnetar flares, QPOs. Those basically tell you mostly about toroidal crust modes. So these are odd parity modes that exist primarily in the crust. They don't really penetrate into the core. So it's mostly a sort of upper crustal constraints on the things like the shear modulus. You have this the properties of the gravitational wave from the in-spiral alone, which primarily tell you things about the mass and the radius and the Love number, which mostly depend only on the core equation of state. So if you can do this multi-messenger astroseismology using this precursor flare, you can constrain sort of the area in between, right where the crust and the core meet. And perhaps this would give you constraints on the elasticity properties that you could use, you know, to help in the previous talk. Do I have a summary? Yeah, I do. So there's a summary. Questions? Oh, yeah, right. It could possibly be, but I'm not sure about the timing involved. There was some recent papers that looked at, I can't remember who they were by now, but they looked at dependence of equation of state on whether or not a hypermassive neutron star would form. And all of these models that they plugged in tended to only last no more than 10 milliseconds.
Yeah, but then there is a question. I mean, that's one scale. The next scale is, you could dump a bunch of energy in the media around this object, reprocess, and then send that energy. I mean, we have no clue how much time they will be there.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a big uncertainty. That's why having the gravitational wave signal would tell us so much. Then we'd be able to time it directly off of the gravitational wave signal rather than worrying about when the merger actually occurs.
How well understood is the mechanism from the shattering to the production of gamma rays? is it just energetics, or do you know a bit more than that?
So right now we have energetics, and we were trying to build an emission model out of like an ancient starquake model from the late 80s by Blaise and Goldreich and Blanford. And right now it's pretty much just this. So we have the energetics. It's questionable whether or not, magnetic field going into the core would take all the energy or not. And we suspect that if the magnetic field is too low, all you're going to do is heat and maybe melt the crust, but you're never going to see a signature of that before the neutron star emerges in a couple seconds. So you probably don't see these precursor flares before a lot of these mergers. You need probably special conditions like the magnetic field being bigger than a certain amount.
Could you show me the light curve again? And could you tell me how to draw the light curve in this? Yeah, a light curve is over there.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So this light curve, all I did was I did a coupling between, I did the impedance matching between seismic waves and magnetic field. And that gives me a sort of time scale at which seismic waves will be able to leave the crust and go into the magnetosphere. Mm-hmm. I built a spectra of seismic waves by just sort of doing a equal energy in log bins, mm-hmm. and then a cutoff below a characteristic frequency of basically the shear speed divided by the crust thickness. And then I just drove it all over the effective driving time that this mode would last.
So what is a typical energy scale? Is kilo electron volt or MeV or the energy scale itself?
Oh, you mean what's conversion between ergs?
Yeah.
I don't know what the conversion is between ergs and MeV. 6 × 10⁵? MeV per erg? What does that come out to, Evan?
You go down about 7 orders of magnitude.
Okay.
To get MeV. No.
But maybe the question was, what would be the energy of the photons?
Oh,
that
I see.
That was the question, right?
So I see. That is far beyond the modeling I've managed to accomplish so far. It would probably peak lower than the gamma ray burst energies, but we're not sure. The gamma factors would probably be higher in the short gamma ray burst ones. But right now, we only have data in sort of the hard X-rays, so it's hard to constrain it that way. Yeah. And, you know, our magnetospheric model here is so loosey-goosey that, you know, we can't really claim a spectrum.
Okay, more questions? Shouldn't spectrum be similar to spectrum of flares from magnetars?
Well, the magnetar flares, like, it all depends on magnetic field strength, a lot of it. And the magnetar flares, the field strength is much, much stronger than we'd expect here. I would note that you have different channels in the on SWIFT, so the sort of hardness ratio in the hard X-rays is the same for the precursor flares as well and the magnetar flare. I don't know what that tells you, but if they're both sort of in the same tail, it doesn't really tell you sort of where things turn over, but that's some constraint anyways. If we can't generate that with this, then it's not a good model.
Okay. If there are no other questions, then let's thank both speakers again.